KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Carlos.
Berkeley.
Potrero Hill.
Vivo in Union City.
Coming up, a grand bargain on housing moves forward, but some key leaders are not on board.
What we have is a terrible process that all of us should be embarrassed. We should be angry about the way we see democracy slipping through our fingers.
Then it's been more than 5 years since the 49ers left Candlestick Park, and now there's a play about their final season.
It's really about family. It's also about gentrification, what happened to black people in San Francisco.
And we got a throwback to another era in NFL history.
Unbelievable, absolutely impossible dream of a play. The Raiders won the football game.
Yes, it's Cross Currents. It's being called a grand bargain on housing. Today, we're going to start the show talking about a new regional plan to address something we've been talking about for a while, the affordability crisis. After a year and a half of negotiations, a diverse group of Bay Area officials, housing advocates, developers, and other stakeholders have signed off on what they're calling a grand bargain on housing. It's a blueprint for a regional plan for all 101 Bay Area cities, and it's called the CASA Compact. What is it? Well, I've got KLW's housing and economy reporter, Liza Veal, here. Hi, Liza.
Hi.
So, who's been a part of these negotiations?
Primarily, there are two big regional agencies involved. So there's ABAG, which is the Association of Bay Area Governments, all the different cities represented there. And then there's the MTC, or the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, mm-hmm. and that has representatives from each of the counties. But then there are also people who weren't voting on this plan but were involved in the negotiations. Mm-hmm. So that was business executives from places like Facebook and Google. There were housing developers, union reps, and a lot of tenant advocates.
Okay, so what does compact mean? Does that mean all of these folks reach some kind of consensus? They all agreed?
Definitely not. This is the housing world. Didn't happen.
Uh-huh.
MTC and ABAG, they voted to approve the compact, but they did it over some dissent from the public and also from some of the representatives that were involved in the discussions.
So that's a lot of people who don't always agree with each other. What was the tone of this debate?
You know, like most housing drama, it's been dramatic. Debate at the final MTC meeting went on for 4 hours. Here's an example. Here's Heather Hood from the group Enterprise Community Partners, and she's urging people to vote for the compact.
Look, I think that it's all of our responsibility to take care of our housing crisis. And when was the last time you saw so many different sectors and people agreeing on some things that we should do together and disagreeing heartily, but getting over it? That rarely happens. So it's a sign of hope. We are not going to spend many more years fighting about maps. We are not going to spend many more years worrying about the democratic process, because there are homeless people and vulnerable people all around the region. I pass them all the time. It's heartbreaking and irresponsible for all of us to continue on with this folly about it.
Okay, so Liza, let's back up a little bit. How did this compact come about?
Well, so the idea is a lot of these big plans to address the housing crisis, they keep failing at mm-hmm. the state level. And the compact, it's not legislation. It's just a plan that will have to then be turned into a bill or a ballot measure and then passed. Mm-hmm. But the hope is maybe it'll actually have a chance of passing if all these different factions that usually oppose each other are politically united from the outset.
Mm-hmm. So, but a region-wide plan means giving up local control. So maybe, I'm guessing that continues to be a hard sell for some local governments then.
Yeah. I mean, the compact that was approved, it's basically made up of 10 policies that would apply almost universally to the entire region. So it's true that places would lose some local power over how they build and regulate housing. But I mean, a lot of people see that as, you know, doing what's right for the region, not just for their own town.
Uh-huh. But it sounds like the debate was pretty contentious. So what were some of the sticking points?
Well, so people who come from this regional perspective, which is basically the members of ABAG and MTC, they're usually more sympathetic with these universal policies because they say, you know, that's the most effective way to plan for new residents and also future residents, you know, to do it in a way that's equal to the scale of the problem. Mm-hmm. But people who live in or work for a specific community, you know, they're less willing to kind of overlook the consequences of some of those things, mm-hmm. which are, you know, things like displacing people of color from their neighborhoods or making a small, tight-knit town a lot bigger.
Okay, but there's a plan and they did endorse it, right?
Yes, they voted for it.
Okay, what's in it?
So the biggest things on the tenant protection side, let's start with that. They basically got like the most minimal version of each kind of protection that was up for debate. So there's a just cause eviction protection, but it's not as strong as the ones in San Francisco and Berkeley and other places. There is an emergency rent cap, but it's really moderate.
Rent cap? Rent control?
Yes, except it expires in 15 years. It's not permanent. And also it's really weak compared to the rent control in the cities that already have it. Like, so for example, in this plan, somebody who's paying $2,000 a month, they could still be getting annual rent hikes of almost $200.
That's a lot.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a little bit of a cap. And then the last piece of the protections is legal aid for tenants who can't pay for a lawyer to represent them in eviction court, mm-hmm. and financial assistance to people who've been evicted. So mm-hmm. that's like the baseline now that would apply to the whole region. And then, of course, if you're in a city that already has stronger protections, then the compact, it doesn't really do anything for you.
Okay. So then the other side of the compact is about building housing.
Yes, the supply side, as they call it. And I should just explain, a lot of this stuff here, this is the deal breaker for some people. You know, the idea of upzoning neighborhoods and helping developers build market rate housing, you know, it's contested whether that helps with affordability or doesn't. So this is where CASA breaks down for some people. And the most controversial piece is about streamlining development near transit and rezoning those areas to be higher density, like apartments. And that's going to be market rate and affordable.
Okay. So how much new housing are we talking about?
The target is to build 35,000 each year. And historically, we build less than half that number in a year. So it's a change.
Okay. How much of that would be affordable?
In this plan, it would be about 60% of those units would be affordable, but that's to low-income and also moderate-income families.
Okay, so that sounds like it all went well. There's some rent protections. There's some new housing. What's missing here?
Well, a lot of groups in the housing advocacy world, they weren't won over. You know, they felt left out of the process. So, for example, here's Susan Kirsch. She's the founder of Livable California.
I would say this is not the last best hope. What we have is a terrible process that all of us should be embarrassed. We should be angry about the way we see democracy slipping through our fingers. There has been like a dark cloud around getting information out.
So these people, they're tenant advocates or they're small town representatives, they might feel like her. And the thing is, they have a lot of organized supporters to campaign against any legislation coming out of Sacramento. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the whole point was to get everybody on board so that something can actually pass from this. And I'm not sure that that happened.
So I sense pessimism in your voice.
I mean, yeah, it sort of just feels like the same people who opposed the past plans to create more housing, they still do, even after all this talk of grand bargaining, you know?
All right, we will check back later in the year to see how the compact is doing. Thanks, Liza. Liza Veal is KALW's economics reporter. If you've got a story you'd like her to cover, reach her at economy@KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba, and it is Super Bowl week, so let's talk some football and theater. Candlestick is the latest production from San Francisco theater company Campo Santo. The drama follows a group of longtime Bayview residents and 49ers fans tailgating during the team's final season at Candlestick Park. And it explores the changing face of the Bay Area before the Niners move to Santa Clara. Lead actor Donald Lacey sat down with KALW's Janae Darden to talk about the show and his life in East Oakland. And by the way, he's a lifelong Raiders fan.
So the play Candlestick is about family, and it's the last season that the Niners are playing actually in San Francisco.
Yes.
So who do you play?
I play Lyle, who is the patriarch of the 49er Nation. He's been coming to 49ers since he was a little bitty boy. It's his whole life. And now he's faced with this process, the prospect of no longer being able to come from where he used to walk to the stick. And it's a real stretch because I grew up a diehard Raider fan.
I was going to ask you, were you a Niners fan?
This is the toughest. So I used to hate the Niners because it was San Francisco and Oakland. And that's how it was us
so
against
this is
it.
Real acting.
Girl, I'm the biggest Niner fan. This is the greatest acting challenge of my career. But it's really Ben Fisher, the writer, is a genius. It's really about family. It's also about gentrification, what happened to black people in San Francisco, or how we have pretty much disappeared. I think it's down to 3%.
Yeah, it's very low. Yeah.
Black population or whatever it is. It's about that whole movement. It's one of those, when the show is over, you just feel, ugh, because you go through so many different human emotion. And it's really, if people want to feel, in the theater where we're doing it, ACT's Costume Shop, it's so intimate. I'm as close to the audience as I am to you right now. Mm-hmm. So you really feel the human experience.
Where did you grow up in Oakland?
I grew up in East Oakland.
That's right.
107th and East 14th.
That's the deep east.
Yeah.
That's what they call it now.
I grew up in the mid to late 60s at the height of the Black Consciousness Movement. Mm-hmm. The Black Panthers were very present, which contributed to my conscious raising. So growing up in that environment where Oakland was the best black city in the world, there was always a good mix of folk from all ethnicities and walks of life. But it was, for the most part, as we saw it, as a black city, and it was a safe city. You know, we would play in the summertime out till 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. Nobody got shot. There'd be a few fights.
Right, right.
But that's the backdrop that I grew up in. And I always tell the youngsters I mentor now, I wish I could take you in a time capsule and show you the Oakland I grew up in. And then you could see, as compared to it is now, how great we were and how that's what we need to aspire to get back to, a real sense of community.
When I met you, they said you were the governor.
Yes, unofficially. I'm the governor. So, you know, yeah, whatever that entails. I don't get no salary. But no, I think because of my community activism and my reach to young people, are my passion. I love young people. I learn from, I always tell people, you know, you work with young people. What's that teaching experience about? I always have to correct them and say, you mean that learning experience? Because I don't know nothing about, you know, what it's like from a young person's perspective to be in this instant age, this social media age, where everything you do is under a microscope, where there's peer pressure, where there's pressure about sexual identity and this and that, and all the isms and schisms that young people confront. So when I'm in a room of young people, after I say who I am and tell them my story, I listen. I want to learn. I want to hear from you. And the reward for me of working with young people is I learn just as much as I teach.
And I know you came up with the motto, Oakland's motto, love life. I think definitely growing up in East Oakland, there's a pain and a beauty to it.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better. That's exactly what it is, pain and beauty, yes.
I know you experienced the pain, losing your daughter to a shooting. And that I understand that inspired the love life motto. Can you share?
Absolutely, and thank you for asking. My daughter, Loiche, Adama Lacey. Loiche is a combination of the Nigerian and Igbo dialect, and it means love life. I gave her that name maybe a day and a half after she was born because of the way she came into the world. I delivered her on 580 freeway while driving. True story.
Amazing.
I had one hand on the wheel and one hand between her mom's leg, pulling her head. And, you know, in fact, on her birth certificate, she came out right over there by 73rd on 580, right mm-hmm. around between 73rd and 98, somewhere in there. And I gave her that name because the Bible says the name of a person should aptly describe the attributes. And I figured she was so eager and had such a lust and love for life, she couldn't wait to get to the hospital. So that's why I gave her that name. And her birth certificate says, place of birth, 580 Freeway.
Wow, really?
Attending physician, Donald Lacey. She was just an incredible young lady. She was vibrant. She was always at a 10. You know, she was always just, she was just full of loving, wonderful energy. And her name really did describe her. So, unfortunately, when I was in Los Angeles at the time working, October 20, 1997, she was picked up, her and a friend of hers, by a young man in the neighborhood. She was coming from her part-time job at McDonald's, and he lived around the corner from them, and he offered them a ride. Sometime between the time he picked him up and the time he stopped near her house, right around the corner, someone followed them in a car with four men. And apparently, this young man had gotten in a dispute or something, and they were looking for him. So, and they didn't know who was in the car because he had tinted windows or whatever. So anyway, when the car stopped, the four men parked about a block away, ran up on the front, shooting at him. And my daughter was sitting behind him, and the other young lady was in the front, and he ducked, and she caught the majority of the gunfire. And quite naturally, you know, like any parent, I was devastated to lose. But I'll never forget that night. I was calling everybody that night, trying to find out what was going on, what was happening, why it happened, blah, blah, blah. But the last person I talked to at 7 in the morning was my grandmother, Mother Franklin, who lived to be almost 102 years old. And she told me, she said, what the devil meant for evil, God was going to turn to good. I put the word out because everybody was telling me, we think we know. Tell us, Mr. Lacey, we'll push that button. And I put the word out. The word even got out to the shot callers in San Quentin. Don't touch them dudes. I don't want, it ain't about, you know, revenge. And I don't want that on my daughter's ledger. My daughter's death is going to stand for something good. And sure enough, you know, we started the Love Life Foundation. We didn't have no money. We were operating from a friend I went to college with, his house. You know, we had a couple thousand people, including Barbara Lee, the mayor at the time, L.U. Hurst. We marched from the spot where she was slain through the neighborhood where the killers was from. We had this vigil we would do on her birthday, which, by the way, this play that I'm doing opens on her birthday.
Oh, wow.
How serendipitous is that?
What a blessing,
right? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we just started doing the work. And Love Life was voted on April 5th, I believe, 2016, by a 5-3 vote. And it's now the motto. All the entering Oakland signs say Love Life, not just to honor my daughter, but to honor anybody whose life has been taken and to remind us this is what we need to do. So it's not lost on me. My daughter's mission before she came into the world was to put this message out.
That was Camposanto actor Donald Lacey speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. You can catch Donald in the show Candlestick. It's playing at ACT's Costume Shop Theater through this weekend. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now we're going to go a little further in our tour of Bay Area sports history with an audiograph, one of the signature sounds of the Bay Area. And this one isn't about a place. It's about a person. And his name was Bill King.
Holy Toledo! The element of surprise reigns supreme!
Bill King died back in 2005 at the age of 78, but he's still well remembered. As a matter of fact, the broadcast booth at the Oakland Coliseum is named after him. That's where I went to talk with the man who knew Bill as well as anybody else.
My name is Ken Korak. I'm the radio broadcaster for the Oakland A's.
Ken joined Bill in 1996 and called games with him for a decade. Ken's first introduction to Bill was over the airwaves in the 1960s as a kid living in L.A. That's when he'd hear the AM signal making its way down from San Francisco's Cow Palace.
Warriors 8 down, 3:29 to go here in the second quarter.
And late at night, I could hear the Warrior games clear as could be, and I couldn't wait at night to listen to Bill broadcast the Warriors. So he was a profound influence on me from that standpoint. And, of course, I didn't know a whole lot about him except through pictures, and he had a very unique look, as you know.
Bill King was a character with character. He had a waxed mustache and a devilish beard.
He was a smallish man, I would say average size when he was in his prime, maybe about 5'8", 5'9". He didn't weigh a whole lot, I don't know, maybe more than 155 pounds.
But he stood out when hired by Oakland Raiders general manager Scotty Sterling in 1966. Bill showed up to training camp that summer in Santa Rosa.
And Bill had this aversion to shoes and socks and pants. His signature outfit would have been Speedos and flip-flops. And Bill was sitting on the sidelines watching practice. And
Raiders owner Al Davis walked by.
And he turned to Scotty and said, "Who is this scrawny little guy? And you know, what can he possibly know about football?" And Scotty turned to Al and he said, "Al, that's your new radio announcer."
That's a pass, go Stabler. Looking. He runs. He's at the 15. He throws. It is a touchdown, Raiders. I can't even see the receiver.
Bill King threaded beautiful storylines in sports and in everything else.
Bill brought a passion to every second of his life. If he was reading the morning paper, he immersed himself in it to the point where that was like the most important reading of the morning paper in the history of the world.
And it was the Raiders' promised land. Fun to kick. The conversion is good.
Bill read all the time, often Russian literature. He learned to sail and traveled the world from his home base of Sausalito. He loved art and opera. Ken says Bill's voracious appetite for living was also simply a voracious appetite.
Well, we have a popcorn machine back here in the press box, and he would start with the popcorn. That was kind of the base of the dish. And then he would smother it with nacho cheese sauce, and then onions and peppers and tomatoes and whatever else he could find that he would put on top of that. He would eat raw slabs of butter. He loved to just eat butter, like, you know, right off the tray. He'd walk, you know, he'd find a room service tray and he'd eat the butter. But then he would also, the finest restaurants in the country, fine dining, waiters in tuxedos, white linen tablecloth, and he would love that. He was a connoisseur of fine wine. Bill ran the full spectrum.
His dinner parties at home and on the road were legendary. He counted basketball player Wilt Chamberlain as a friend, along with other top athletes. He loved spending time with them, but not so much the people who enforced the rules of the game.
Bill was very emotional when it came to referees and umpires, and I think authority figures in general were not his favorite people.
That became quite clear in a basketball game he called on December 6th, 1968.
It was a very intense game between the Warriors and the Sonics. And at the end of the game, there had been a lot of calls that had gone either way and gone against the Warriors.
Bill became enraged at referee Ed Rush.
Bill stood up, took his headset off, and he motioned to an engineer to cut the mic, and he yelled an expletive.
He called the ref a motherfucker.
His mic was cut, but the crowd mic was wide open. And so here he was on 50,000 watts. The entire Bay Area could hear what he said to Ed Rush, and it became known as Mother's Day.
Though I did see that he did appreciate a good call now and then, too.
I never saw that. No, he prohibited me from even talking to an umpire.
He also helped Ken become the voice of the A's.
The way that Bill reached out to me and accepted me and brought me into the booth as a partner, I always had the feeling that maybe our fans were thinking, the A's fans were thinking, if Bill King thinks this guy is okay, then maybe he's okay.
The two shared many memories in the broadcast booth, like the Scott Hatteberg home run that gave the A's a record 20th consecutive victory on September 4th, 2002.
Now the pitch. Swung on, there's a high drive, hit way back, right center field, that one is gone, and it's 20 consecutive victories for the Oakland Athletics on an unbelievable night when they lost an 11-0 lead, and now they win it.
There are a lot of calls that he made that were iconic, I think.
And no Bill King call is more famous than the end of an Oakland Raiders-San Diego Chargers football game on September 10th, 1978. It's called the Holy Roller.
Here comes the rush. He sidesteps. Can he throw? He can't. The ball flipped forward is loose. A wild scramble. 2 seconds on the clock. Casper grabbing the ball. It is rolled a fumble. Casper has recovered in the end zone. The Oakland Raiders have scored on the most zany, unbelievable, absolutely impossible dream of a play.
When you came to capturing the denouement in a ball game or any kind of a game, you wanted to have Bill King as your announcer because no one could kind of capture those dramatic moments like he did.
Bill King has been called by many people the greatest football announcer who ever called a game. Many more consider him basketball's greatest broadcaster.
He didn't work for the celebrity or the notoriety. He did it because he loved it. Bill was his own man in everything he did, and especially in his broadcasts.
The crowd comes back to insane life.
In Oakland, I'm Ben Trefney for Cross Currents.
Crazy. Just plain crazy.
The legendary Bill King. And if you want to hear more stories like that, subscribe to the Cross Currents weekly newsletter. It's at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This music is by Mahawam from Oakland. He's playing The New Parish this Saturday night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sarah Nora Coast, Kristen McCandless, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Porfirio Rangel, Lisa Wang, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Thodic Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.